Sometimes things must glow without faces.
My name is Jack O'Lantern. This is my diary. Never meant for foreign eyes. Never intended that anyone would read my thoughts. And yet here it lies now, between the dusty shelves of Grimwick, the Nocturne Library, where the bindings crack like old bones, and the dust counts the years like a weary sexton. Today, I write about a single night, the one where streets glow warm with pumpkin light, and the world forgets that masks don't just hide, they seduce. I write about the thin place in reality, about the whisper in suburban reeds, about the ember that keeps me and curses me. Each page lays bare another piece of what I was, what I am, what I must be, as long as the wind smells of smoke and children's voices scratch at the darkness. And since you now hold my words in your hands, lean back, listen to me. This diary doesn't live from images. It lives from my words, from my thoughts, and from what they trigger in your head. You see, I've learned something about consciousness over the centuries. It's flammable. One spark in the right darkness, and a mind catches fire with things it wishes it could unthink. I'm rather good at finding that darkness. Consider this your warning, or your invitation. The two have always looked alike to me. October 31st, 2024, the Night of Thin Walls. Chapter 1, The Keeper of Flame. Sometimes I forget that flames have memories. Not the kind of memory that sorts dates, but a deep, crackling loyalty. Fire remembers every piece of wood it has touched, every breath it has devoured, every face that stood before it. Tonight, as the wind leaped from the desert gullies and filled the suburb with dry leaf gold, I held my ember close to the glass of the world, and it reminded the world of me. It has become a peculiar time when even fear knows the energy-saving mode. No more candles in the pumpkins. Battery-operated tea lights flicker with algorithms that imitate chance. Doors stare at me through black plastic eyes, faces of polyester, cobwebs of filament. Even terror has a delivery date now. And yet there is that one, old, trembling, that arrives punctually like frost on a barn. When the sun tips over, the night lifts its ear to front doors, and I lift mine to my own heart. I am Jack, not the man, not the saint, not the demon. I am the space between, the narrow levee between what the light believes is true and what the shadows know. I have lied to God and shaken hands with hell. Both have denied me passage. So I wander, year after year, night after night. In that hour, the world calls fun, and for me is a fine surgical kit with which I cut the skin of reality a little further open. You want to know what that feels like? Imagine you're a word that two languages argue about. Neither claims you. Both use you. That's been my existence since the turnip days, since the coal in my hands, since the bargain that went beautifully, terribly wrong. I'm the consequence of cleverness, the mortgage on wit, the interest on a deal that compounds eternally, and I've made my peace with it, in the way one makes peace with breathing. Today, asphalt still warm from the day, lawns trimmed so uniformly short as if someone had calculated nature in Excel. On the porches, pumpkins, each with a different face, and yet all committed to the same smile, one that wants to be harmless and is therefore dangerous. I walked past them, so gently that only the dogs held their breath. I am accustomed to being overlooked. The world blinks, and I slip through. The suburb stretched before me like a board game someone had played too seriously. Every house a property, every decoration a strategy. Every child a game piece moving in predictable patterns. But games have rules, and rules have gaps. And gaps are where I live most comfortably. The children came, as they always come, in packs held together by older siblings like an invisible leash. Princesses with thermal underwear, superheroes with light-up shoes, ghosts that smell of sugar. I fell into the stream of the street with them. Another mask among masks, a flame among false flickering. The parents followed in quietly rolling SUVs. Interiors laminated blue by screens. Control. Controlled. Controlling. Between us, the ring cameras, storing every stranger until they seem familiar. But no eye that knows me wants to recognize me. I've walked these streets for more Halloweens than this nation has seen. Watched the evolution. From harvest festivals to trick or treat. From handmade costumes to Amazon Prime. From real fear to manufactured jump scares. The ritual persists. But its meaning has developed a curious amnesia. They remember the fun. They forget the thin places. They forget that one night a year, the membrane between here and there gets so gossamer thin, you can practically read through it. I remember when children were genuinely afraid on this night. Not of me. Never of me specifically, but of the vastness, the unknown, the particular quality of October darkness that tastes different than July darkness. Now they're afraid of missing out, afraid their costume won't trend, afraid the battery in their LED pumpkin will die before the Ring doorbell captures their cuteness. But fear is fear. It just wears different masks now. And I've always been good with masks.
Every diary you hear is bought with hours of life. Be among the first to preserve this library. Become a founding patron. Link in the description.
Chapter 2. The Thin Hours Begin. At a doorstep stood a bowl with the inscription, "Please take only one." The sign was in a font that acted cheerful and gave orders. I stopped. It is an old rite. The bowl is an altar, and the request is a prayer to self-control. The pumpkin beside it, big as a child's head, had teeth lined with candy canes. A hand reached into the bowl and took 2, 3, 4 pieces. Then someone laughed and acted as if no one stood behind him. So I stood behind him. I don't breathe, but I can bend the air. The boy turned around, saw through me into his own reflection in the window. For a second, the future held its breath. Then it let go. He put one back. I rarely take anything. That is the mistake of those who have learned to fear me, that I collect. Number. I ignite. I knock. I lay a small match on the world's tongue and wait to see which words it scorches. I am the breath that stirs memories, and sometimes a memory-seeking breath. The boy couldn't have been more than 13, that age when the body outpaces the conscience, stood there with his hand still hovering over the bowl. His friends had already moved on, their pillowcases swinging with the weight of petty theft. But he remained, just for that heartbeat, just long enough to feel something like shame, or its prettier cousin, reconsideration.
"Connor, come on!"
A voice from the darkness. The boy, Connor, grabbed one more piece and ran. But his gait had changed, just slightly. Just enough that the candy in his bag sounded different. Guilt has a particular rattle. I moved on. The street unfurled before me like a scroll I'd read many times, but never tired of. Same houses, different owners. Same ritual, different fear. Same night, different world. A man in a werewolf mask stood on his lawn, motionless, then suddenly lunged at passing children with a pre-recorded roar from a speaker hidden in his fur. The children, shrieking, shrieked. The parents laughed. The man returned to his position, already thinking about tomorrow, about the quarterly report, about the argument he had this morning about whose turn it was to take out the recycling. I paused beside him, just for a moment, just close enough that he felt a chill that had nothing to do with the October air. He stopped mid-lunge on his next scare, looked around, saw nothing but his own street, his own porch light, his own life. He pulled off the mask earlier than planned, went inside, told his wife he was getting too old for this. She said he was never too old for anything. They both knew she was lying. Little mercies. That's what I deal in mostly. Little reckonings. The vast and terrible comes rarely, and never by my hand. I'm not in the business of damnation. I'm the product of it. I'm in the business of reminders, of thin places, of moments when the script of normality gets a few words crossed out, and people glimpse the palimpsest underneath. Later, I came to a house with an old maple. The leaves hung hesitant, veins red as if embarrassed. Under the tree sat a girl on the bottom step. The costume meant Little Red Riding Hood. The posture said, "Not today." She had pulled the hood deep over her face, but I didn't hear the tears. I smelled them. It's a truth you only learn when you live long enough in the in-between. Grief smells like iron and fermenting earth. Next to her stood a pumpkin, poorly carved, the lines shaky, the light inside restless. "Everything okay?" asked a voice from the darkness of the house. A mother, already half in the kitchen. The girl nodded, though no one could see. I knelt down, as well as I can when I don't really kneel. My ember ducked into the shadow of the pumpkin and whispered courage to it. "It won't burn right," she said, as if she'd heard my thoughts. The stupid wind. Chapter 3. Among the Masked. The wind had something of an old stage tonight, one that knew all the effects. It blew as only a wind can blow that has November at its back, and October still in its teeth. I blew back, not much, just a domestic pact between fire and air. The flame in her pumpkin caught itself, grew, became calmer. On her face, which looked like a small moon phase under the hood, stood a brief wonder. "Thanks," she murmured. And I nodded to a version of me that has learned over centuries that you have to hold on to the small wonders when the big ones only make debts. She didn't know who she was thanking. They never do. That's the beauty of it, really. Gratitude given to the void. It has a purity that directed thanks never quite achieve. She looked at the flame, steadier now, braver. And I saw in her face that particular expression children get when they realize they might, possibly, probably, be capable of magic after all. Not the pulling rabbits from hats kind. The making it through the day kind. Her mother called again. The girl stood, brushed off her red cape, adjusted her basket of imaginary goods for imaginary grandmothers. Before she went in, she touched the pumpkin once, just the side of it, the way you'd touch a friend's shoulder. Solidarity in carved orange flesh. I moved on, trailing the trick-or-treaters like a rumor they couldn't quite place. At the corner with the garbage cans, where the street settles into its old bed, I encountered it again. The other light, There are nights when the will-o'-wisps show themselves. Not the scientific variant, not methane and coincidence, but those blue, lurking eyes that once wore swamps like war paint. They rarely come to the cities, but suburbs have their own swamps. Gardens no one enters because a fence has declared them private. Ponds pumping filters as if they were hearts wanting to wash themselves clean. Construction sites with holes that have no names. From one such hole crept a pale twitch, a bobbing, crooked glimmer. It smelled like wet wire and old shoes. I knew. One of my cousins is here. One from the great family of not quite here and not quite there. We greeted each other as lights greet. A brief silence in the wind. Then each went his way. Me into the streets. It into a property that wore its address on the mailbox like an embossing. It helped nothing. The dog there sensed it and barked with the desperation of an animal that hasn't yet learned that some things bark back. Only quietly. Only inside. The will-o'-wisp. My distant cousin. We don't speak much, we lights. Don't need to. We understand each other in the way that all exiles understand each other. Through the shared language of not belonging. It was headed somewhere specific, I could tell. Had that purposeful drift that comes when a light has found something lost. Or someone losing. The dog, a golden retriever. Family friendly. Probably named something like Bailey or Cooper. Continued barking long after my cousin had passed. The owner came out, looked around, saw nothing, told Bailey to hush, went back inside. Bailey didn't hush. Bailey knew. Animals always know. They just can't articulate it in ways that humans take seriously. So they bark. They hiss. They refuse to enter certain rooms. And humans attribute it to quirks, to personality, to that time Bailey ate something weird at the park. Never to the truth. That Bailey sees the seams. I continued and calculated, as I always calculate on these nights. How much human can myth still endure? How much myth can human still endure? The children screamed, laughed, tipped the weight of night into candy with their bags. At a garage, a fog machine ran. The smoke was well behaved. It scent peanut butter and plastic. Above the garage hung a string of lights in orange, and on the lawn was a projector throwing bats on the wall, as if stone suddenly saw shadows of things it had never touched. I stopped. Shadows are vocabulary that walls speak when they can't say something. These here said, "We miss the stories. We only have the pictures." I did what I can do. I wrote a small story into the air above the driveway, the way you breathe on cold windows. A boy with a plastic axe stopped and stared. He saw nothing, only that his breath suddenly formed a syllable. Mom? He called. And she answered from somewhere between kitchen table and door. I saw how they both took the same step, time delayed, as if they were in an invisible dance that only the night conducted. Between them, the projector did what it could. It painted the air. Chapter 4. The Rituals of Forgetting. Later, I met him. Not the devil. He rarely comes personally. He has people for that. I met one of his former employees, a man who got his contract torn up because he was too conscientious. He stood in his driveway and stared at the pumpkin he hadn't wanted to carve. His wife had said it belonged. He had said it was ridiculous. Now the pumpkin stood there, the knife still beside it, the shell heavy with drawn lines that hadn't become a face. The man smoked. The smoke smelled like argument. I stayed. I am not cruel, I am precise. I whisper to things the form they already have, if one were honest. A face then, he thought. A face that doesn't smile at me. He nodded, as if I had nodded. His hand reached out. The first cut was tentative. The second cut an old memory. A lantern procession. A hand that held his. A voice that said, like this. Always from the edge to the center. Otherwise everything caves in. The hand that held his no longer exists. The pumpkin made a sound you hear everywhere in autumn and recognize nowhere. The clayey, the woody, the fleshy. When something yields more willingly than you thought. At the end stood a face that didn't smile, but it was honest. The man took a step back and has owed me nothing since. I rarely demand payment. My currency is return. I save people like bookmarks. When they open next time, I know where the story gets thinner. The man, I'll call him Marcus because that's what the bills on his passenger seat call him, stood there, looking at his honest pumpkin, for longer than he'd looked at anything in months. His cigarette burned down to the filter. He didn't notice. The pumpkin's face looked back with an expression that could have been resignation or acceptance or both. The line between them has always been thinner than people think. His wife came to the door. Marcus? You coming in? It's getting cold. Yeah, he said, but he didn't move. Not yet. It looks good, she said, softer. It looks real. He nodded, put out the cigarette, picked up the pumpkin. Surprisingly heavy with its own truth, and brought it to the porch. Placed it where the light from inside would reach it but not overwhelm it. Found an old candle stub in the garage, lit it, placed it inside. The flame caught, held, made that face mean something. His wife came out, stood beside him. I'm sorry about this morning, she said. Me too, he said. They watched the pumpkin burn with its honest face. Sometimes the smallest rituals crack the biggest silences. I moved on, leaving them there in their fragile reconciliation. My work isn't to fix things. It's to open the space where fixing becomes possible. The rest is up to them. There were also houses I didn't linger at, those that had issued terror like a lease agreement. "No trespassing," said a sign, and behind it, animated skeletons rolled on tracks. Motors whirred, speakers hissed. That's not my terrain. I am the small fold in the carpet you stumble over when you're too sure. I am the moment when you lock the front door and wonder whether you've locked the back of life or just the front. Machines work against me, but rituals work for me. A child who whispers, "Just this one house, then we go home." That's my wind. A father who calls, "Not on the lawn." That's my break. A grandmother who puts out the bowl and says, "For those who come late." That's my altar. Chapter 5. Where the lights fail. Around 9, a different light settled on the street. Screens went out. The little ones were carried home. The bigger ones met at corners where phones illuminated their faces like modern moon phases. I sat, let's say, I rested, on the curb in front of house number 18. There the porch was empty, but the air was full of what was missing. A woman had always had a glass of cider there for everyone who said, "Thank you." This year there was only a sign. "We grieve this autumn. Please do not ring." The pumpkin stood uncarved beside it, as if wanting to say, "We cannot." I knelt to one of the pumpkins and laid my ember on its flesh. Sometimes things must glow without faces. The woman came to the door. Not quite. Just an arm's breadth. The way you open the world when you endure it, but don't invite it in. She saw the glow emanating from a pumpkin without mouth and eyes. For a moment, she forgot what the year had been and remembered what the years are. I saw how she put her fingers to her throat. A gesture I know. It holds the voice so it doesn't fall down. "Thank you," she said into the darkness. Not to me, but into the vacuum a name had left behind. I nodded to it. That name that no longer answers. I do such things not to be good. I do them because balance is a kind of justice that you reach more easily at night than during the day. She stood there longer than she meant to. The faceless pumpkin glowing with its impossible light. Sometimes the impossible is the only thing that feels true. Sometimes absence needs illumination more than presence does. I've seen grief in every iteration. The loud kind that breaks dishes. The quiet kind that forgets to eat. The complicated kind that laughs at inappropriate moments because the alternative is screaming. Hers was the kind that had learned to function, barely, on the thinnest of threads. "Wake up. Breathe. Make coffee. Exist. Repeat. Don't think about the empty chair. Don't think about the voice that used to call from the other room. Don't think. But thinking isn't optional. It's ambient. It's the air. The pumpkin kept glowing. She kept watching. Somewhere inside the house, a timer went off, a sound meant to signal normalcy. Cookies done, laundry ready, life continuing. She wiped her eyes, just once, quick, as if erasing evidence, and went back inside. But she left the porch light on. Small victories. That's what this night trades in. Around 10 came the emptiness. That's the part of the night the calendars don't know. The decorations have lost their joke. The sugar has given its command. On the sidewalks lie masks, relocated with a certain regret. I collect nothing, but I note the places where children stopped being fearless. They're often the same places where adults started seeming brave. Bravery is an empty cup you hold up so no one sees the tea is cold. I went to the little church at the end of the settlement. It was lit brighter than necessary. Security reasons, state and heavenly. On the lawn, a sign, trunk or treat, thanks for coming. I stood at the edge and heard the last voices fade. A pastor turned off the lights of an inflatable pumpkin arch, and the arch sank together like an animal that sleeps at night. The pastor remained standing, looked into the sky, perhaps counting stars, perhaps worries. He spoke a word that sounds the same in all languages. Softly. Please. I like please. Please is the art that refuses to die. I gave him back a breath of silence that wasn't empty. A silence from which you can build a prayer. He felt it. I know he did. The way he straightened slightly. The way his shoulders dropped half an inch. Relief masquerading as posture correction. He looked around. Saw nothing, of course. And then did something unexpected. He smiled. Not the pastoral smile. Not the professional smile. The real one. The kind that costs something. Thank you, he said to no one. To everyone. To the night itself. Then he went inside, turned off all but the security light, and went home to his own doubts, his own faith, his own small battles with the infinite. I stayed a moment longer. Churches interest me. They're thin places by design, built to be thresholds. Humans constructing doorways to what they hope exists. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it's just architecture. Tonight, for him, it worked. Chapter 6, The Unlit Candle. Later, when the fog artists had dismantled everything and only the breaths of air conditioners timed the neighborhood, I returned to a house I had marked at the beginning. Not with chalk, with memory. There lived a boy with a too fast mind and too slow patience. He had spent the whole evening trying to scare others, not because he was mean, but because he wanted to force the world to finally react. You recognize them immediately. Their eyes are always half a second ahead of their movements. On the porch of his house stood three pumpkins, two artful, one crooked, the crooked one was his. He had hated it. He had guided the knife too hard, as if the vegetable had to yield like an opinion. Now he sat before it and contemplated his work, while the LED inside dutifully repeated its algorithm. I sat beside him. He naturally didn't see me. But you sense company, even when it casts no shadow. "I didn't get it right," he said into the air. I nodded. "The others are better." I remained silent. Silence is a tool that belongs to no one. It makes honest. I thought it would be, I don't know, scary. But somehow it looks like it's apologizing. I contemplated the pumpkin. A mouth that had turned out too small. Eyes that had uncertainly wanted to become large. I placed my ember inside, not to make it prettier, but so it would know itself. The light filled the wrong angles, made faults into folds, trembling into character. The boy moved closer. "Ah," he made, that short, surprised sound people make when they meet themselves and hadn't planned it. He stretched out his hand as if wanting to hold the light, and pulled it back, as if knowing it doesn't work. "Thanks," he said, though he didn't know to whom. The boy, maybe 12, that awful age when you're expected to be everything and nothing simultaneously, tilted his head, studied his creation with new eyes. The pumpkin's apologetic face suddenly seemed less like failure and more like vulnerability. Honesty. A face that knew it wasn't perfect and was okay with that. "Huh," he said, which is 12-year-old for profound realization. I was already standing when his father opened the door. "Come in, champ," he said, pretending the word wasn't borrowed from a movie. The boy stood up, later than his father's gesture, but early enough not to be late. They went inside. I stayed a heartbeat, mine, which isn't one, longer. Inside, a television flickered, but it seemed more tired than both of them. Before the door closed, I heard the boy say, "Dad, can we keep it out here all week?" "Keep what?" "The pumpkin. My pumpkin." Then. "Yeah. Yeah, we can do that." Small victories. The night trades in them exclusively. I walked on, through streets that were settling into their evening routines. Porch lights clicking off in sequence. The synchronized shutdown of suburban consciousness. Dogs being let out for final patrols. Garage doors descending like eyelids. The great organism of the neighborhood preparing for sleep. But not quite sleeping. Not yet. There's always an hour, this hour, when the suburb holds its breath between day and night, between public and private, between the face it shows and the face it hides. This is my hour. The hour of thin walls and thinner pretenses. At another house, whose garden was too orderly, the decorations had been prettier in the catalog. But here the wind cut at them, and they looked offended. Behind the window stood a woman who held her hands to a cup like to an altar. beside her a man who said, "It's late." She said nothing. Sometimes, love is the art of using words only tomorrow. On the windowsill lay a candle, a real one, which they didn't light because children are at hand, and insurances are too. I brushed past it with my ember. For a breath, it made a small, brave flame. The woman smiled. The man stopped repeating the time. The flame died, as flames do. But its image remained in the glass a second longer. And sometimes a second is enough to save the year. Chapter 7. Until the veil thins again. Midnight came without bells. It comes like a habit no one confesses. I walk the street up and down. The last lights went dark. The last candies counted themselves. I thought of turnips, of the small hard heads we used to hollow, in a time that isn't earlier, but different. I thought of the coal pieces that were given to me. Scorn and grace in one. I thought of the word between. It's a word that can be a cradle and a knife. On this night, I again placed many things between each other. Children and courage. Adults and memory. Houses and their stories, lights and their shadows. I am no judge. I am a gap. Once more, I stopped in front of a house whose garden was too neat. The decorations had been more beautiful in the catalog. Here, however, the wind cut at them. And they looked insulted. Behind the window stood a woman who laid her hands on a cup like on an altar. Beside her, a man who said, "It's late." She said nothing. Sometimes love is the art of using words only tomorrow. On the windowsill lay a candle, a real one, which they didn't light because the children are at hand, and the insurance companies too. I grazed past it with my ember. For a breath it made a small, brave flame. The woman smiled. The man stopped repeating the time. The flame died, as flames do. But its image remained in the glass another second longer. And sometimes a second is enough to save the year. As the night grew thinner and the east remembered a little that it had a direction, I returned to my place. I have no place in the human sense. Address, coordinates, deposited keys. My place is an in-between space where the air doesn't know whose side it's on. There I laid my ember to rest like an animal that has learned to duck. I counted in my head, a habit that serves not to think about what cannot be thought. I counted faces I didn't collect, doors I didn't open, paths I didn't relocate. I counted the pastor and his pleas, the man with the honest pumpkin, the woman with the uncarved flame, the boy who became similar to his light, the girl with the hood who said, "Thanks," without knowing to whom, The sum of such nights is not happiness, but it is weight. And weight prevents you from flying away. Weight. That's what I've accumulated instead of years. Moments instead of memories. Encounters instead of possessions. I own nothing. Can't really in my condition. But I've collected enough weight to keep me tethered to this world, this night, this eternal return. Before I withdrew completely, I turned to you, who read me, though I don't mean you. It's not hubris, it's economy. Stories are fuel, and I've become economical. So I lay a small bill on your table. When you put out the bowl next year, put a second one beside it, for what you miss. When you carve, don't cut beautifully, but truly. When you think a candle impossible, let it breathe anyway. When you write a sign, let it ask and not command. These little things are the doors I don't go through, because whoever goes through doors must eventually knock. I come in differently. Turn off the lights if you must, but save yourself a match. The last thing I saw before the veil thickened again, a child's handprint on a window, small and perfect. Tomorrow someone will clean it. Tomorrow someone will wonder why it makes them sad. Tomorrow someone will pause just for a heartbeat and remember something they never experienced but somehow know. That's me. Still working. Still walking. Still waiting. Until next October, when the walls thin again, it is almost time again, when the lanterns burn once more, and the wind turns the suburbs like pages, I will be there, where you lift the handle only slightly. Listen. It's already crackling.
Archivist's note. I am Dr. Erasmus Grimwick, keeper of the shelves at Grimwick, the Nocturne Library. You have just completed another entry in our collection, The Diary of Jack-O-Lantern, October 31st, 2024. Let me tell you how this manuscript came to us. It materialized on our intake desk during the autumn equinox. No delivery notice, no return address, just there. It smelled faintly of burnt pumpkin flesh and was accompanied by a single ember that refused to extinguish. We tried water, sand, vacuum seal. The ember simply continued. Eventually, we learned to leave it alone. Now, Jack-O-Lantern represents something unique in our archives. You see, most of our collection deals with human monsters. The meticulous accountings of Jeffrey Dahmer. The grotesque artistry in John Wayne Gacy's journals. Ed Gein's isolated madness, documented in his ranch records. Or the blood-soaked mystery of Jack the Ripper's Whitechapel letters. These are human evils. Comprehensible in their way. Terrifying, yes, but human. Jack is different. He exists in the liminal space between myth and manifestation. Neither fully human nor wholly demon. Neither dead nor precisely alive. He is, as he states himself, the gap. Most of our human collections span 50 entries each. complete chronicles of descent, madness, and method. Dracula's Transylvanian Journals remain our founding acquisition and most requested series, though I should warn you, the waiting list extends 7 years and requires blood type verification. We are currently processing the extensive diaries of H.H. Holmes and Ted Bundy. Both promise to be comprehensive. But occasionally, an entry arrives that stands alone. A special account. A singular night. A glimpse rather than a chronicle. This diary of Jack-O-Lantern is precisely such a rarity. One evening's wandering. One October's testament. One flame's confession. For those seeking deeper understanding, I recommend cross-referencing our archive sections on Celtic mythology and Samhain rituals, the Will-o'-the-Wisp phenomenon, and the anthropology of Halloween itself. Jack's origins trace to the Irish legend of Stingy Jack, a clever soul who trapped the devil himself and was subsequently barred from both heaven and hell, doomed to wander the earth with only a hollowed turnip and burning coal to light his way. Over centuries, the turnip became pumpkin, the coal became ember, and the wandering became purposeful. This diary will remain in our restricted access wing, available only to those who understand that reading is an act of invitation. Jack writes not merely to confess, but to connect. Each reader becomes a thin place, each page a threshold. Handle accordingly. We have more coming, of course. Always more. The Basement Tapes, a suburban chronicle. The Smiling Man's Logbook, currently in authentication. Memoirs from the Floorboards, arrival date unknown. The Countess Bathory's Beauty Regimen, still in translation. Entries continue to arrive by methods both conventional and otherwise. Volumes from entities still walking, still watching, still writing their confessions in the margins of our world. Check back often. The shelves fill themselves. Remember, some books find their readers. These books find their victims. This is Dr. Erasmus Grimwick signing off. We keep what should be kept.